You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and welcome. You are listening to Final Draft. It is a half hour of books, writing, and literary culture every week for the first time in 2020. But we are still enjoying the books of 2019. We're only a few days in, so we're going to get to 2020's new releases soon. Today on the show, I have a fantastic conversation with Fleur MacDonald. She is sometimes known as the voice of the Outback, and her books are enjoyed by thousands of readers. We will be discussing her latest, starting from now, and getting into some of the issues that do impact rural communities that she conveys in her writing. Also, later on in the show, I will be sharing some of my picks from 2019. Something new for me on the show, sharing this. I don't like to be judgy, but I wanted to share some books that have had, you know, a real impact on me. It is as always fantastic to be here with you. Happy New Year, however you have celebrated, and let's look forward to a fantastic year of 2020. Starting after this very short break.
Electronic producer John Hopkins brings his live AV show with Grand Piano to the Opera House this January. Drawing from an incredible back catalogue, as well as his latest Grammy Award nominated album, Singularity. Book now for John Hopkins, January 5, at sydneyoperahouse.com. Sponsors are 2SER.
You are on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It's books, writing, and literary culture every week. My name is Andrew Popel, and I am very happy to be joined on the line by Fleur MacDonald. Fleur is a best-selling author of Australian rural fiction with hits such as Blue Skies and Red Dust. You have met her on the show if you are a long-time listener. Fleur, welcome back. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, hi, Andrew. It's nice to be back with you.
It is great to be talking. It's hard to keep up. You've got two books coming out pretty much every year, but we're well past a dozen now. And the latest we're going to be discussing is Starting From Now, which is sort of your Christmas offering for this year.
Yep, it sure is. I write the two books a year, and Christmas is a great time to be able to release a book. You know, and hopefully give the gift of reading with all of that. Yeah, with the Christmas book.
And in Starting From Now, we have Zara Ellison. She's a reporter with the Farming Telegraph. She's just finishing up a big story of a protest gone wrong, resulting in a man's death, when she gets the call from home. Now, her brother's cancer has progressed. He has maybe a few months left. Packing up her Adelaide apartment, Zara returns to Barker, a town that has always felt a little too small for her, and a life that she left as a teenager off to boarding school with dreams of the world. That's our setup. Zara has to sort of adjust to this life and this absolute tragedy that is happening within her family. But I was hoping perhaps that we could actually start with a moment in the book between Zara and another character, Sophie Graud. Sophie is the daughter of the protester who was killed whilst sabotaging equipment as part of a protest. And in this exchange, Sophie tells Zara that what she's interested in, why she's a protester, why she is doing these things, is for transparency, for helping others, people who don't know much about farming, and helping them understand what goes on behind the gate. I wondered perhaps if that resonated for you as you were writing, and in your novels, many readers are getting perhaps their most intimate view of farming life. Do you feel a responsibility in the things that you portray and representing that to sort of a wider population?
Yeah, I certainly do. I farmed for 20 plus years. I only sort of got out of farming probably about 5 years ago, and not for any reason other than the fact that I just didn't live on the farm anymore. I had a divorce. So I still own land. I love farming, and we have a wonderful industry that has a lot of transparency that sometimes people actually don't realise that the transparency is there. So I love to be able to bring a world that I know very, very well into people's lounge rooms or cars or wherever they're reading, so they can understand a little bit about what we do and why we do it. And when I brought the activists into it, I felt that was a really important link to bring in, because we just, when I started writing this book, Aussie Farm Maps had just been had just hit the internet, and that was where people listed farmers' addresses and names and telephone numbers, and encouraged people to go onto people's farms and trespass. And that's, to me, that was horrifying, because, you know, we, our farms are our homes. And yeah, we've got young children and or older children, and it also poses a really huge biosecurity risk. So I just wanted people to understand why it was quite confronting for farmers, but I also wanted people that were farmers to perhaps read this book to understand the activist point of view as well. So I tried to do, I tried to show an unbiased view on both sides.
Now, Zara is undoubtedly your protagonist, but as I read, Zara and Sophie seem to me to be perfect foils. Both have experienced tragedy, the loss of a father at a young age. Both are committed to education and to educating the public, telling them truths that they personally believe are important. And they're both committed to the welfare of animals, especially within the farming community, albeit from widely differing perspectives. What were you, you've touched on this a little bit, but what were you interested in contrasting the stories of these two women and, in a way, having them cross over at different points in their narrative?
So I guess Sophie was probably a product of having to need somebody to be an activist, and Zara came from, you know, I needed her to have an understanding of farming background. So I needed two very, very different women, which I hope, you know, I hope I've created. But I think to get them together and to for them just to show respect to each other. So we that was my intention for both of them, that they needed to be able to show respect for each other, because I feel that that's what we need to do in real life, to show everyone can have differing opinions. And both Zara and Sophie's opinions probably look from the surface that they are similar, but like you say, they come from very different backgrounds. And it's nice to be able to portray the differences there, and for them to be able to respect and each other and each other's differing opinions and not get so antsy with each other.
It's a really interesting the ways that you contrasted. So Sophie as an activist, and it's not revealing too much to say there's an issue with drones being flown over farms and the community are not sure where this is coming from. And what that has the effect of doing from the protest perspective is, in theory, they can sort of just dump live video. So it's in theory, again, not edited. It's showing a true vision. And with Zara, she is very much interested in balanced reporting, and she actually quite often makes that distinction to people that she is there to report. She is interested in balance. She's not trying to journalize or sensationalize the story, and how we actually consume media and the sources that we find to be reliable, to be trustworthy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes we see in the media that they like to sensationalise things and perhaps not tell exactly, they tell the story from, I guess, the way that they see it, and sometimes it is sensationalised. Really balanced and honest reporting is a good way to be. So, yeah, I've tried to get Zara to be like that.
Now, the division between rural and metropolitan life is highlighted for Zara, especially as she's asked to perhaps think about giving up her job in the bustling newsroom and return to the farm. I mean, it's a terrible situation that's happening with her brother, and her mother's going to need help on the farm. We also see it in the story of Senior Constable Jack Higgins. I'm going to be very careful what I reveal in the story here, but he is a sort of honest secondman in Adelaide, and he's really struggling to adjust to city life, even, you know, just a small apartment with a balcony and there's a smoker on the nearby balcony. It's also a bit of a cliche of Australian life to have this divide between the country and the city. But I wonder, do you feel like, is it something that's getting wider in our modern world? Is it becoming an insurmountable divide?
I think while we've got people or farmers dedicated to, you know, talking to other people and like people from the city and showing and happy to show city counterparts what we do, that the gap is still there, but it's not insurmountable. I think it is really wide, and we've got to do a lot to be able to close that and get information to people that don't understand farming or haven't been involved. It's not so much they don't understand it, they just haven't been involved with it. So it's not insurmountable. It's certainly getting to that point, but we have some really great active online farmers who talk to people and will answer questions. And I'm involved in a Facebook page called Outback Paparazzi, which we started for that particular reason. You know, we wanted to document and photograph as for three photographers, me and two other girls on there. And we started that because we wanted to show the beauty of the country, but if we wanted it to be a safe place for people to come and ask questions about farming. So there certainly are people out there that are trying to bridge the gap, and I guess that's what I'm trying to do in the books as well, is, like I said before, just take a life that I know very, very well into somebody else's world that perhaps they wouldn't have seen what I've seen. And because I've farmed, I have authenticity with that. I can talk about it with authenticity, I suppose.
I was really interested in the fact that Zara is a reporter, which is traditionally a very immersive role. These are people who are constantly thinking about stories and constantly researching. You know, you don't clock off if something is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to farm life, but again, you've got that metropolitan versus country divide. There are others in this world who are just, they want to clock off at 5 o'clock. They want to be able to turn their life off. Zara can't do that. And if she were to go back to the farm, she couldn't do that. Is it a mindset? Are some people just constantly in that living their work kind of life?
I think that's my life. because I've always wanted to be, one of the things I really wanted to do when I was younger was be a rural reporter. So I've had a great time living Zara's life through this book. And I guess, farming has always consumed me when I was farming. And writing consumes me. You can't just shut off from that either, because you'll find that there's something will turn up that you need to write down straight away, otherwise you'll forget it. The same goes for journalism. They're always looking for stories. So I think also that not shutting off is part of our world these days, part of everybody's world. There's not, with the constantness of mobile phones and being able to be contacted all the time, there would be very few people that do honestly shut off from the minute that they walk in the door at whatever time they finish work to when they go back to work the next morning. So I think that's just a reflection of our society these days.
How do we reconcile that then? Because I think when you give the mobile phone example, the idea that you can be answering work emails as you fall asleep in the middle of the night, there's not going to be many people that argue that's probably a net bad and we need to step away from that. But when we come back to the example of farming, I mean, if something happens, it has to be dealt with. The farm relies on it. We can't say that's a net bad. We rely on farmers. How does that balance exist?
The work-life balance in farming? I think that you would be pushed to find people that that have a work-life balance in farming. Especially the people that own their land themselves. Companies have policies in place where, the employees have to have their, they only work for 6 days or 5.5 days or whatever. So the employees often get their time. But if you are a private landowner, and I'm just thinking about my previous circumstance and, quite a few of the family farming operations that I know, even if there are staff there, you have to give them the time off. So then you have to be there to cover when they're not there. So I probably couldn't tell you any farmer that I know that has got that work-life balance,
It does
down pat.
Yeah, it does, and it does seem almost untenable, especially for the people who subject themselves to this. And I thought Will's story actually presented this really interesting balance to the discussion of rural and metropolitan life. As he lays dying, he's still devoted to the land that he's worked on his entire very short life. He's installed technology that allows him to farm from his sickbed, but he also wonders to his sister at the things that he's missed out on by never straying far from the farm's boundaries. Now, the isolation of the bush, adequate support and infrastructure, they occupy national debate. And right now, we've got a PM who seems to think that rural fireys don't mind leaving family and work for extended periods, you know, to be fighting the fires that just seem to be ripping the country apart. Do you feel like enough is being done to support rural communities?
That's a really interesting question, because in some ways I do and in some ways I don't. Yeah, if you look at Bridget McKenzie's office has just announced a $20 million grant to keep agricultural shows going. So, you know, that's a great way of supporting communities in rural areas. But, you know, again, you've got comments like what Scott Morrison made about the fires as well. So in some ways I do think we are supported. In other ways I don't. I find, in another part of my life I run a not-for-profit organisation called Breaking the Silence, which supports individuals within domestic violence situations just wholly and solely based in rural areas. And I get frustrated when I see how many services we get taken away because government funding has been pulled on a service, you know. So I think probably more than not, we're probably not supported, but in other ways we are. And again, it's really hard talking about a drought policy a drought policy that needs to be brought into agriculture. We can't do that when we are in the midst of a drought because the emotions run too high. We can't have a really solid, good business plan to go forward when droughts are there if we're trying to do it while we're in the middle of it, because all we're doing is playing catch up.
Yeah, it must be very hard to hear rationalisations and glib explanations about economies of scale when on the ground those are lives, that's people's trauma that's actually being rationalised.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I am speaking with Fleur McDonald. Her latest novel is Starting From Now, and you may have gathered from this conversation that there is so much to consider wherever in Australia you are about what is happening in rural Australia and how we are all actually connected despite the fact that there may feel like this divide. Fleur, look, thank you so much for the opportunity to chat and for really getting into the themes and issues of Starting From Now.
Oh, thank you for having me, Andrew.
It is time now to take a track. Before we come back, I have got a bit of a 2019 wrap-up, some of my selections in books from the year. This is from Rwandan band The Good Ones, and it is called Will You Be My Protector?
Agira ngo nundeba nyirijuru we ya makuba nyavamo kubera ibiganza byawe ubundambitseho mbabarira umbera umurinzi w'igihe cyose nyirijuru we mbabarira umbera umurinzi w'igihe cyose nyirijuru we Chesha rababi buze nyirijuru we kureba ni wowe bikesha rababi buze nyirijuru we kumva ni wowe bikesha rababi buze nyirijuru we kuvuga ni wowe bikesha rababi buze nyirijuru we Zahora muririmba
gusenga nyirijuru we nzahora nkuririmba kandi gusenga nyirijuru we
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3 and you are listening to Final Draft. It's books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel. Now, right there, we heard a track from Rwandan band The Good Ones. That track was called Will You Be My Protector? And now, as promised, I've got a bit of a wrap-up of 2019 to kind of get our 2020 started. If you are looking for some things to read, this is going to be a time when I'm going to tell you what I think you should be reading. You know, I don't think I've ever done an end-of-year list for Final Draft. If you, you know, catch me during the day, I'll happily recommend you a recent fave read, but I've never collated a selection to present in any formal way. One of my goals at Final Draft is to present Australian writing and Australian writers in a way that might intrigue and captivate, perhaps challenge, but never judge. Having the extraordinary opportunity to meet and discuss with so many literary minds, I'd prefer if they hold the stage so that you, the listener, can get more of the books you love. I don't always love every book that I read, but I also understand that many of these books will have readers that love them. I also understand that these books are not written exclusively for my personal edification, so I try to approach them with an open heart. It's quite difficult then for me to collate a list of the best or select from a certain period of books one that's more worthy than others. I have a huge respect for those who can and I eagerly devour awards lists and wrap-ups, but I guess I've always been a little reluctant to try it myself. I mean, I read a lot, but nothing close to every single Australian release in a given period, so I won't even pretend to, you know, take in the entire scope of Aussie writing. So this, then, is a list of books that have personally impacted me this year. They're all 2019 releases, and they're all Australian, which meant a few books from writers working in Australia missed out because I wanted the list to reflect stories being told about Australia. I've also left off some hugely entertaining books because they didn't move me in the same way as these works have. It's a highly unsatisfactory process, and I thank you for sticking with me this far. I guess if I could tell you what to read, I would say, read these works from 2019. They all have something important to say about our world, our country, our lives, and our future. They've challenged me, they've given me tears and troubled sleep, but they've also left me with the feeling that reading and being part of a literary community is a very fine thing to be. And so, without any further mucking around, here are some of my favourite reads from 2019. Starting off the list, I have Alison Whittaker's Blackwork. Blackwork is a collection of Alison Whittaker's poetry and essay covering personal and social biography, satire and critique. It explores Alison's life as a First Nations woman and her experiences as a poet and a lawyer. Alison's collection and the opportunity that I had speaking with her for Final Draft helped crystallise for me threads of thoughts about the ways in which I read and the impact of that reading. At the beginning of the year, I undertook to review the ways Final Draft represented voices in our community. It was important to me that voices of First Nations people, as well as queer and other non-white, non-dominant culture writing, was featured on the show. In Blackwork, and through Alison's writing, I discovered that just having representation is really only a first step. That we read writers from a variety of cultural or otherwise perspectives means nothing if we fail to challenge the dominant colonial lens through which we read. Now, maybe what I'm saying doesn't resonate with you. Maybe it makes you feel uncomfortable. Maybe you feel like being told how to read is a betrayal of why you engage with literary discussion. But for me, through Blackwork, through Alison Whittaker's writing, I discovered a need to challenge, to decolonize my reading and to approach the literature that I consume in new ways. So next up, I have Alice Bishop's A Constant Hum. A Constant Hum is a short story collection. It presents a collection of stories exploring the aftermath of bushfire. Across nearly 50 stories, the collection looks at the many ways we try to understand and move forward when catastrophic events occur. At the time of A Constant Hum's release, I spoke with Alice and reviewed A Constant Hum. I wrote that the stories are visceral and sensory, opening up a world that the average reader may never experience. Now, mere months later, and across the country, Australians are getting a first-hand understanding of fire and its seemingly new place in our summer life. Still, many of us will live our city lives without confronting a wall of flames, but none of us are unaffected anymore. And so Alison's stories in A Constant Hum open up a space where stories can be shared, and these stories help us begin to make sense of, I don't know, something that we're all coming to call the new normal. Third on my list is Christos Tsolkas's Damascus. Damascus tells the story of Saul of Tarsus. Saul was a Greek-speaking Jew, a tent maker who some 2,000 years ago was met on the road to Damascus by a blinding light and was convinced that he must bring the teachings of the Jewish prophet Jesus to the world. This is a story perhaps well known to many, whilst others may have little understanding of the tent maker whose letters came to spread Christianity to the world. And in Damascus, Christos Tsolkas takes the story of Saul, the man, and explores his life and the origins of that early church. Christos's book was a challenge to me in so many ways. Raised a Catholic, my initial reaction was, do I really need to go into these stories that I've been subject to as a part of my youth? It's also a departure from the stories of contemporary Australia that many of Christos Tsolkas's readers will be familiar with, you know, the slap and barracuda, the sorts of stories that we also, you know, really typically explore on Final Draft. So I resisted initially and squirmed through, you know, those early pages of reading. There is something about Christos's writing, though, visceral and charged. He brought me into a world where religion and social life was fractured and people sought truth amidst falsehood. The book didn't seek my conversion, and there was no road to Damascus moment for me. But in elucidating an historical moment and revealing characters from their dogmatic caricatures, I was able to engage with these stories in a way that showed me more of a world that I guess I'd long dismissed as irrelevant. Now, last on my list is Tara June Winch's The Yield. The Yield is a story of Australia told across three distinct narratives. Albert Gondawindi is writing a dictionary that he hopes will revive his language and culture for his family, particularly after he dies. August, his granddaughter, is returning to Prosperous House to farewell her grandfather, just as miners arrive to plunder the land for tin. And through the letters of Reverend Ferdinand Greenleaf, we are taken back to the founding of Prosperous House and see exposed the racism and discrimination at the heart of these relations some a century earlier before Albert's story. The Yield is quite simply an extraordinary literary work that I wish everyone could read for its style, its linguistic dexterity, its remarkable story, and so many more small features that go into holding us as readers transfixed between its pages. It's one of many books that found me this year and challenged my thinking about the ways I read and try to understand my world and place in Australia. I've already mentioned Alison Whittaker's Black Work and the challenge of decolonizing my reading. I'll also mention here Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu and Tyson Yunkaporta's Sand Talk. Amongst these works, The Yield stands up as a narrative that engages with the ways we read and understand history and culture and the reckoning that must be had between our colonial invader history and the history and culture of First Nations people, a history that spreads back tens of thousands of years, a history that was so brutally damaged but not destroyed. Mundungawu is the Wiradjuri word for thank you that I learnt while I was reading The Yield, and I will say Mundungawu again to Tara and all these writers I mentioned, though not all of them are Wiradjuri people. I'll also say Mundungawu to you, my listeners. Thank you for taking an interest in the books that had an effect and moved me this year. We do have another fantastic year now in 2020 to look forward to reading, and I look forward to bringing those conversations to you. It is almost time for me to say goodbye. Final Draft is regrettably only a half hour where we get to talk about books, but that's no reason to not take this out into your world. And I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Every week I sit down with fantastic Australian authors, and believe it or not, when it comes to talking books, I can't limit myself to half an hour. Often those conversations go much longer, and I don't get to share them all with you on the show. So the Great Conversations podcast is a place to hear more of those fantastic chats. There is something like 100 conversations with Australian authors and other authors up online already. So go to wherever you get your podcasts, whether it be Spotify, whether it be iTunes, whether it be a different podcatcher, find Final Draft Great Conversations, subscribe for a new conversation every week. My name is Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more from Final Draft. Till then, happy reading.